From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As of press time Monday, the Tax Reform Act of 2017 was still in reconciliation between the House and Senate, with key provisions still undecided. Nevertheless, the media and politicians on both sides predicted either doom and gloom or, with equal certainty, promises of an economic renaissance. To parse some of this, we spoke with economist Richard Wolff, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and a visiting professor presently in the graduate program in international affairs of the New School University in New York. We spoke with him via Skype from New York Monday. Dr. Wolff, it's a pleasure to have you back. It's been much too long.
Thank you, Don. I feel the same way. Okay, let me talk about things that I think are true pretty much no matter which way the negotiations end up. They don't seem to be negotiations or reconciliation that throws into doubt the broad outlines of what is being done here. So let me talk about those. The first, and I think the most important, is that such an act, as it passes, represents another significant major step in the redistribution of wealth and income upward in this economy. In other words, this is Robin Hood in reverse. It takes from the middle and the poor, and it gives to those at the top. This would be bad enough for those of us who care about such things. But it is even more stunning to see such an act happen at the end of a 30-year period during which the same thing was done every year, every other year. I mean, we have seen, for example, the top rate of the personal income tax go from the 90% in the 50s and 60s of the last century, then to 70% in the 70s and into the early 80s. So we now see it at 35 or 39%, depending on how you count it. So we've seen over the last 30 years cuts on the order of 50%, 70%, something for those at the top that nobody else enjoyed. Nobody else enjoyed anything like that kind of a tax cut. Likewise, we have seen over the last 30 years that the corporations of the United States found ways, which the IRS did not take away from them, to escape the 35% formal rate of taxes on corporate profits. They did so by all kinds of exemptions and deductions that they got written into the law. But probably the bulk of the money was simply moved out of the country to tax havens around the world, again, utilizing laws that were passed in that period of time, so that the corporations didn't ever pay 35%. I believe the average was in the neighborhood of 25, 27%, which is roughly what they pay in other parts of the world. But they were also able to go to the Cayman Islands or Ireland or other places where they could escape the taxes. So the big corporations and the rich have had a tax holiday for 30 years, which explains in large part the kind of inequality that has gotten so much worse.
Yeah, and
the last 30 years.
On that point, let me just ask something, because you know, you're talking about basically another round of gouging of the from the bottom. And it's kind of remarkable, because the last 30 years have been fairly thorough in doing that, where we're looking at something like 2/3 to 3/4 of the people don't even have $500 to $1,000 net worth.
Yeah, I mean, for me, that's the grotesquerie. What you seem to now be on is no longer a steady, regular shifting of the inequality. What you now begin to see in this bill is quantum leaps. That is, an inequality that has gotten so bad that those at the top no longer worry about it. They are in a rush, almost, you could see, to grab it all before it disappears, to use the fact that they have already so much concentrated wealth that they can buy the system, the political system, to get even more, and that that's what they could do and should do and must do. And then, by the way, some of them have said this to me, and then when the blowback comes, yeah, they'll lose a third or a half of it, but it will be so big by that time that they'll still be the richest people in the society after that blowback happens. And therefore, not to grab more now, not to have a tax bill like this that gives them even more, would be self-destructive. And therefore, they've worked out in their minds, this is the right thing for them to do. And when you push them, their answer is, this is the right thing to do because we can get away with it.
Mm. Ouch.
For me, this represents a kind of final step in the end of a period of American capitalism coming right out of the Great Depression, in which the prideful point, the best rationalization for capitalism Americans could come up with, was that it created a vast middle class, that it took the mass of the working class, or at least most of it, the white part, the male part especially, and lifted them to a state of middle classedness which was so wonderful and so historically unique that you should celebrate capitalism for that achievement. That's over. That's gone. This act will be the final brick burying that claim. They're going to have to come up with other things, and they are doing that, because this capitalism produces grotesque inequality, not a vast middle class. You even had the election last year in which all the major candidates promised that they would rescue, save, reassess, redevelop the middle class. And clearly nothing remotely like that has happened or is on the agenda of any significant political force.
Hmm. You know, it's interesting. I was listening last week to a speech that one of the theoreticians, one might say, of the Trump administration made in Washington, D.C., Steve Bannon, who comes out of Wall Street, out of Goldman Sachs specifically, essentially made the following statements, and unequivocally. Number one, the $4-point-some-odd-trillion weight of the so-called war against terrorism has been a complete, you know, disaster economically. And two, the U.S. military bases around the world, which also operate with, you know, the rest of the budget over the last 15 years, I think he used as a basis, were several other trillions of dollars. And the destruction of community banks, savings and loans, and all of that has meant that there's basically no financial, you know, possibilities, no assistance available for reconstructing a middle class. And I'm wondering why, like, the theory that's being spoken, even, you know, in those circles, well, actually, that's about the only place I've heard it, why we're not seeing any policy actualized along those lines at all. I mean, no one's talking about setting up community banks, for example, in, you know, at a policy level.
Well, I think without being too mean-spirited, I think it's explained by the same phenomena that mean that Mnuchin and Cohn remain at the White House and Mr. Bannon doesn't. In other words, what Mr. Bannon is good for is the popular, the if I were mean, I'd say fascist, but okay, I can say the attempt to have some framework, some ideas that you can go to this vast middle class and make them believe, if you're good at it, if you work at it, that voting for Republicans is in some way going to help you as a middle of the income distribution person or something like that. And the party needs that. It has always needed that. Otherwise, I mean, what would the Republican Party be? Take a step back. The Republican Party has been always what the Democratic Party is now, namely financially dependent on the folks at the top, either the corporations or the people who become rich because they are shareholders or top executives of those corporations. And the Republicans, therefore, have always had what you might call their Gramsci problem. They represent way too small a slice of the American voters. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if they're going to do the job they have set themselves up to do, namely provide supports, subsidies, exemptions, and everything else for corporations and the rich, they have got to have a mass base. They got to go find it. So, of course, they will embrace evangelical Christianity if they can cut a deal with them. And Mr. Trump comes along and says, I'm going to give you more than symbols. I'm actually going to give you a bunch of stuff. Great, then you're better than either of the two Bushes or people like that, the traditional people. And Mr. Bannon is the same thing. In his case, it has nothing to do with Christian fundamentalism, whatever he may say. What it's about is this appeal to a kind of popular middle-class self-delusion that this Republican Party, whatever their doubts, is better than the Democrats. It somehow is going to really do something for them. And Bannon correctly knows that doing that, saying that, pushing that, is part of the only way the Republicans can stay in office. My guess is Mr. Bannon, whose main interest seems to be a kind of we-can-go-it-alone U.S. nationalism of an old kind that has always existed in the United States. That's his real thing, and he sees the Republican Party as the vehicle, and that means he understands that he has to pay a price. He has to pander to the rich who are at the top because they run the Republican Party, and he has to pander or at least quietly acknowledge the Christian fundamentalists, because those are another part of the base. And so he wants them to give him the space, which they're doing, to go run around and say, I, as a leading Republican, promise you up and down that this will happen and that will happen. And look how daring I am. I'm saying that the defense budget is too large and that should be cut back, and the money saved thereby should help you in the middle class. You should be able to get a loan from your local bank more easily than you have been. You should be given these tax breaks, those tax breaks, and we're working on it, and you should vote for us. The Democrats don't care because they either serve the folks at the top or they serve the folks at the bottom. You are not of interest to them, therefore you should go with that. This is a very old gambit, and I think that's what Mr. Bannon is doing.
And this inside the Republican Party, that's a pretty common, you know, historical mode. You know, looking at that, I mean, and, you know, we're Marxists. I've heard you say it enough about yourself to say that, to call you one. And the reason I bring it up is that as Marxists, when we look at history, we generally try to not look at the, you know, big man, big event, you know, narrative of history, but rather history as, you know, a bunch of social processes, economic activity, things that are in motion, moving forward, and right, it can be studied that way. And so we're looking at it, we're at a moment in our history where you describe the Republicans and how the someone like Bannon and some others relate to their constituency in the middle class, make these promises. Of course, you know, the promises get made and broken, and people understand that. We're at a point where we have a crisis of legitimacy among the constituencies, the Republican Party, also the Democratic Party. Democrats are supposed to promise labor all these things, and they've been steadily taking it away since the 1940s, and certainly since the 1980s at an accelerated rate. And so you have among the population a palpable sense that the structures, the institutions are not responsive to their needs as their needs compound. And I'm wondering, you know, say Bannon can sell this for so long to the Republicans, and the Democrats aren't really selling anything other than Russiagate and Trump to their base. You know, how long can that go on?
Yes, well, that's the that's the big question. A part of me wants to answer you by saying it can't go on very long. But I'm afraid there's another part of me that's a bit more pessimistic. And that wonders, you know, as this system fails, as this new tax law, for example, begins to show millions of quote-unquote middle-class Americans that they've just taken another knock on their situation, will Trump and the Republicans and Bannon be able to get them to believe that if they, let's take an example, throw every Mexican they can find over the border back into Mexico, this will somehow fix their situation. Well, I remember, my pessimistic side does, many years ago, I think it was the 1960s or early 70s, and I was living at that time and working in New Haven, Connecticut, and it had its share of hippies those days, people who had their hair long and wore certain kinds of styles of clothing and so on. And there was some demonstration about something not that controversial. So I was involved in it, and so were a lot of these young people who were, as everyone used to call them, hippies. But at a certain point, I don't remember even why, I stepped out of the line of march near a construction site. And there were a bunch of guys who were construction workers. And they were talking to one another, "I'm going to kill those hippies." This sort of mean-spirited, nasty, but said with real passion so that I could understand what they aimed their passion at made no sense, but the passion itself was real enough. Right. So I tried to talk to them since I didn't look like the, you know, I was teaching at Yale and, you know, I didn't look like the folks they were yelling at.
The kids, yeah.
And I said to them, "Yeah, you know, what is this?" And they mumbled, "Those kids never worked a day in their life," all that kind of stuff. And I said, let me ask you a question. Suppose you really could do it. Suppose you could line up all those young people over there up against the wall and shoot them dead. What do you think it would do to your personal life? At the end of that day, set aside the horror of what you had just done. Do you think you would have gotten a better job because you killed them? Do you think you would have gotten more income than you killed? What would it do for you? And they looked at me with total befuddlement.
Right. Never thought it through. Right.
They never worried about that. You know, they fumbled and bumbled. They couldn't come up with anything. They felt a little embarrassed, to be fair to them, that they didn't, you know, and they did recoil at the horror of doing this. They weren't monsters. They weren't about to do that. But I tried, in a way, to learn. It wasn't a rhetorical question. I wanted to get at, what in the world is it going to do for you to be hateful towards these people? What? What do you care whether they dress like that? What do you care that they're... And, you know, as we talk, here's the only thing I learned. And I know this sounds strange, but it's what I learned. That in a way, those workers were jealous. What they were jealous of was a stereotype of their own creation. That these young people don't work, that these people don't have any income issues, right, that these people don't have a career for themselves that they're worried about. All things which I, as the teacher of people just like that, knew to be false. Right. But they had constructed people who were free of the work pressure that these guys lived under. And they were jealous and angry that something in those young people's lives exempted them from what these construction workers had no choice but to do. Right. It made me more sympathetic to them, but it also made me aware of how one can turn a legitimate resentment about one's situation into a demonization of a group that is in no way responsible for that situation. Yeah. So will Mr. Trump and Mr. Bannon be able to turn all of their own failures, policy failures, into a Holocaust for immigrants? I don't know. It's certainly something that a good percentage of them are eager to do anyway.
You know, at the bottom of that, I don't know if the students you're talking about were students at Yale. I don't know how.
Some were, yes.
Okay. So, but generally, I would say just like any other group, the chunk that you'd pull out of the population, probably a good portion of them are working class. What you have are, you know, members of a class that should be united in order to obtain economic power, if that's what's driving them at the base, and instead at each other's throats, which is kind of the game that's been played, in the game of class warfare from the beginning. Yep. And it's what we saw in the last election, and we see that on the streets today. And it's represented on both sides to this degree that when you talk about this group of people being irredeemable and this group of people being less than human, which is essentially what all of that boils down to, the prospects for class unity are nil. And absent that, I don't know where anything goes.
Right. That's the beauty of the performance for the system that the Republicans and the Democrats perform. And it can't be said too often. If you focus on everything other than the system itself and its mechanisms for causing trouble, then you are, whether you intend it or not, serving the system. Because what you're doing is instructing every critical impulse in the population you deal with to search for the solution anywhere else but system change.
Right.
Because you have got... You're going to focus on one or another real or imagined social ill. You're going to focus on one or another bad politician who has to be removed or a good one who has to be elected. I mean, it never ends.
Right.
The one thing that you cannot do is say, gee, there ought to be a political party out there advocating for why we need system change. And, you know, what that means is that you've trained your population. If you're dissatisfied with whoever is in power, get the other one. There is no other one other than another one who supports capitalism, because that's the way the politics in this country are set up. And this gives you then this illusion, which is all it ever was, an illusion of democratic choice among alternatives, when what you've actually done is taken the most important alternative and made it impossible for that alternative to get a hearing, to get discussed, to be advocated for, or anything else. If I have any hope in this situation, it is that the taboo on an alternative to capitalism, that has been broken. Something has happened in the last 5 years in the United States, and there's a growing disconnect because there are millions and millions of Americans now who do see that the system is the problem and who are now interested in what alternatives exist. And that is the most dangerous thing for the kind of head in the sand mentality that has governed politics since the late 40s.
And finally, one of the things that you've been working on, front and center is the idea of democratizing the workplace.
Right.
And one of the, things that have been done trying to get from here to there in the condition that we're describing has been for people to start constructing the world that they would like to see. Do you have any suggestions or ideas or some discussion perhaps of that whole model?
Right. Well, for me, there's a number of things that make me and people like me focus more and more on the workplace. And let me just rattle off two or three so you can see them. Number one, it brings, if you like, anti-capitalism down to a level where everybody can see what it might mean for him, for her, in their daily life. It stops being what it was in the 20th and 19th century, some grand campaign that changes things at the top of society. It changes the government, changes the relationship between the government and the organization at the top of enterprises, carries out that whole long history of thinking that the alternative to capitalism, where private individuals own and operate enterprises, that the real alternative to that is to have the government, some officials, do that. I think that was a mistake anyway. I think what that did was refuse to face the fact that if socialism or an alternative to capitalism was ever to capture the imagination of the mass of people for very long, it could include changes at the top for sure, but it had to also fundamentally offer a different life all day, every day, to people, to be the kind of meaningful transformation that could get their loyalty, get their commitment, and get their labor to make it happen. So you have to bring, if you like, socialism right down into the household where you live, into the workplace where you work. And talking about a transition from a hierarchical capitalist enterprise, where a tiny group of people at the top, major shareholders and the boards of directors they elect, telling everybody else what to do, literally, and whether they even have a job or have an income or not, is neither necessary nor desirable, especially for people who take democracy seriously, and that you could organize enterprises in a democratic way. Yes, you would get all the usual naysayers who repeat, by the way, for the corporation, exactly what monarchists used to repeat for the kings of this world, that you needed to have these people at the top because a society couldn't work if it didn't have a king at the head of it. And that's no more reasonable than to say that a corporation or a business couldn't work unless there are a tiny number of people making all the key decisions at the top. The second reason I do this is because it puts my enemies off balance, which if you're going to do this kind of political work, you always have to think about that. The people who've hated alternatives to capitalism, the champions of capitalism, have for 150 years honed their critique of socialists by focusing on the government. Socialists give the government too much power. Socialists make the government intrude on your life. Socialists make the government powerful and rich, and you a lowly subject with nothing, etc., etc. In other words, their critique of socialism is a critique of the state variety, of the kinds of socialism that gave a lot of power, indeed, to the state, etc. By focusing on worker co-ops as the alternative, as the project we're creating, you demobilize your critics. They don't know what to say to you. A worker co-op isn't a scary idea. It is immediately attractive to all kinds of working people, has nothing to do with the state, and therefore is exempt from all of that anti-state stuff that the defenders of capitalism have specialized in. And so it gives me and people like me an extraordinary advantage in talking to people about a change every bit as fundamental as anything socialists have ever done, but in a realm that the critics of socialism have never focused themselves on and really aren't very well equipped to counteract. And finally, what you bring up, we can do it. Even under the existing laws of the United States, which, by the way, vary from state to state, but in many states, not only is it possible for people who want to set up a worker co-op business, but the laws are designed to make it easier than you might imagine. Laws are designed to make the finding of capital, with money with which to start such a business, are easier. And so it is a manageable thing to do. And unlike what happened in the 60s and 70s, where young people who wanted to opt out, and I'm exaggerating here, but, you know, went off to Vermont and to grew organic turnips or something. Right. This is something that doesn't require or even want you to leave the world in which you've grown up. It doesn't want you to leave an urban area for a rural one. It doesn't want you to produce a new or different commodity. I mean, you can do all those things, but it's not necessary, because what you're really doing and what you're celebrating is a new way of relating to one another in the workplace, which is where adults spend most of their lives. And it's going to make that workplace much more pleasurable, much more satisfying, much more of a developmental environment for you to find and to improve skills you didn't even know you had, because you're going to have two job descriptions in every worker co-op. One, the particular task you do in the division of labor, and the other one, your required participation in being on the board of directors, being the worker who is also a leader, a designer, a controller, a director. And that's going to bring you into a new realm of activity, which is going to change your life. And a socialism that promises to change your life directly, whatever happens in the larger society and at the top, is a whole new way of approaching not only what's going wrong in people's lives today, but a whole new way of conceiving an alternative. And I think it's our best chance forward.
And that's all the news we have for you right now.
For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.